That's right, that's right. Purim has special powers, you see. Okay. So a very, very Purim Sameach to everyone. A happy Purim to everyone. Talk about the armored chairs at the back. You want? Up to you. Purim is considered an amazing festival. We know that the sages tell us that when Mashiach comes, the divine light, the power of revelation will be so strong that all the other festivals, as special as they are, will actually pale into insignificance. The exception, one of the exceptions to that is Purim. Purim, it says, will still be a significant festival when Mashiach comes. And I think I mentioned this last week, that the Zohar tells us that Purim is even more powerful than, it's similar, but even more powerful than Yom Kippur. Because Yom Kippur is called Yom Kippurim, and therefore the word Kippurim means Kippurim, like Purim. Not quite like Purim, but it's like Purim. So Purim is even greater. And maybe in the course of today's discussion, we'll try and understand why. It's an interesting thing to explore, because really it's not one of the biblical mitzvot, it's one of the rabbinic mitzvot, it came later. So what is the power of Purim? So I thought what we do today, being that we actually, this is a regular session and we're in the middle of a series, we've been going through a book, for those that aren't regulars, we've been going through lessons from this book called Make Your Bed by William McRaven. This is a very, very decorated admiral and graduate from the Navy SEAL in the US. And he gave a big speech and then wrote it into a book talking about the 10 lessons that he learned from Navy training. Great lessons that are critical for life experience, and we've been going through them. So today what I'm going to do is take a chapter. Take a chapter that's a bit out of order, but a chapter that I think is very connected to the Purim message. So we'll keep our series going, but we'll direct it in a Purim direction. So we're actually going to do chapter 10, which is called Don't Ever, Ever Ring the Bell. So I normally have it on the screen, some of the excerpts, but let me just sort of read just a few lines from chapter 10 outside, and then we'll talk about it and explore it and connect it to the Purim theme. So he writes that he said, I stood at attention along with other 150 students beginning the first day of SEAL training. Then he goes on to say how the instructor came and started screaming at them and said, gentlemen, today is the first day of SEAL training. For the next 6 months, you will undergo the toughest course of instruction in the United States military. And then he said, you're going to be tested like no time in your life. Most of you will not make it through. He smiled. I will see to that. I will do everything in my power to make you quit. I will harass you. I will embarrass you. I will push you beyond your limits and so on and so forth. Then he grabbed the bell and he said, grabbing the bell, he pulled the rope hard and a loud clanging noise echoed across the courtyard. And he said the following, but if you don't like the pain, if you don't like all the harassment, there's an easy way out. He pulled the rope again and another wave of deep metallic sound reverberated off the buildings. All you have to do to quit is ring this bell 3 times. He says, ring the bell and you won't have to get up early. Ring the bell and you won't have to do the long runs, the cold swims or the obstacle course. Ring the bell and you can avoid all this pain. And then something, and then suddenly he turns his way of talking and he says, but let me tell you something, he said. If you quit, you'll regret it the rest of your life. Quitting never makes anything easier. He says 6 months later, there were only 33 of them left. Some had taken the easy way out, but they would regret it for the rest of their lives, as he had said. So then he ends off the chapter and he says the following. He says, of all the lessons that I learned in SEAL training, this was the most important. Never quit. It doesn't sound particularly profound, but life constantly puts you in situations where quitting seems so much easier than continuing on, where the odds are so stacked against you that giving up seems the rational thing to do. But the lesson is, don't ring the bell and never quit. So it's a simple but profound lesson that he talks about in this chapter. It's a clear lesson. The lesson is, life has challenges, but in a very simple and powerful way, he says we're not here to quit, we're not here to ring the bell. Now, what I want to do is explore this concept a little bit, right? And understand this lesson. And where do we get the ability from not to quit? And understand also that this idea, right, of not quitting challenge actually can be understood on many levels. First of all, we know as a Jewish community, communally, it's a communal message as well. So we know, if you look in Jewish history, and this will tie right into the Purim story in a moment, we had plenty of times throughout our history to give up. We didn't. Am Yisrael, the Jewish nation, are a resilient nation. We've always never quit, and we've always pushed on, we've always moved on, even after tremendous challenge and tremendous hardship and tremendous persecution and oppression. So that's on a communal lesson. We've learned this lesson, and we have this lesson, and we need to move forward with this lesson, even facing the challenges, or some of the challenges we face today as a nation. But of course, this lesson is also individually, right? So we talk about, in the face of challenge on any level, external challenge that we have, hardship that we go through, sickness, God forbid, tragedy, whatever the case is, which could bring a person to want to quit. The lesson here is very clear. Quitting never makes it easier, and we have the ability not to quit. But when we talk about individually, there's individually on another level, individually sort of internal challenge, right? Which is an equal kind of challenge. We've talked about this before. When we have challenges that are emotional challenges, personality challenges, personal growth challenges, where we've tried to succeed, we've tried to grow, and things just keep getting in the way. Things keep standing in the way. Spiritual struggle, where we want to grow spiritually, but we don't seem to be able to do it. So we have all of these different challenges on different levels in different contexts. And the message he wants to drive home in the final chapter of the book, actually, which it's chapter 10, is that don't ring the bell, never quit. So this is where, to develop this idea, this is where the power of Purim comes in. Besides Om HaTashin, Purim actually, yeah, that's one. Have self-control, only eat one, right? No, you've got to eat them, it's a custom, but only one. Or two. No. So if we explore Purim, Purim obviously has many components, the festival of Purim, right? But one of the messages, one of the very strong messages of Purim is, specifically Purim, more than any other festival, is the ability and the power not to give up, right? To bounce back, not to despair, to transform, to find light in darkness, right? Or light after darkness. And let's develop this for one moment, because if you have a look at all the other festivals, Jewish festivals throughout the year, they're all radically different. Why do I say that? Every festival takes place in a time in history, or in a context or an environment where there's a spirit of closeness between the Jewish people and God. There's a miraculous environment. There's a revelation, divine energy that is so obvious. For example, take Pesach. The Yontif of Pesach, which we celebrate, which we're going to do in a month from now. Didn't want to spoil your Purim, but it is in a month. Pesach, Purim means that Pesach's in a month. No, just kidding. But Pesach, we celebrate the exodus from the Jewish people from Egypt, the birth of the Jewish nation. But don't forget, it comes after 10 plagues where the Jews saw miracle after miracle. Yes, there was a long exile, but the preparation to that, it didn't take much for them to say, yes, there's hope. After all, they saw it in front of their eyes. They got taken out of Egypt miraculously. They crossed the Red Sea. We then have Shavuot, where we stood in front of Mount Sinai, where to have hope and have inspiration wasn't difficult. There was such clarity. There was such a divine revelation. There was such amazing miracles happening that it was kind of easy almost. Sukkot is when we celebrate the fact that God protected us miraculously again with the clouds of glory throughout the time in the desert. Hanukkah even, where there was a challenging time, but when the miracle happened, it was so open. Take a little bit of oil that's supposed to last for one night and lasts for eight nights. A war that's won incredibly miraculously of a few Jews, a small army with a few elephants fighting a massive Greek-Syrian army, which was amazing, right? And Purim is completely different. Purim is the only festival, as we know, as we've talked about this before, I think that Purim is the only festival where on all levels, in every step of the way, before the story and after the story, God is completely hidden in every way. There's nowhere to run. First of all, historically, we need to understand Ahasuerus, who gave the consent for the order of Haman to annihilate the Jewish people, it was different to any other time in history. Even in the darkest times of history, the Spanish Inquisition, even the Holocaust, there was always places where the decree didn't apply. Haman's decree was to annihilate the entire Jewish nation, and they had nowhere to run because he was the king over the entire inhabited world at the time. 127 provinces in that area of the world was the only place that there were the Jewish people at the time, and there was nowhere to run. Everywhere you ran was under his regime. And they were spiritually low. It was a time of great spiritual decline, which Haman was very well aware of. He comes to Ahasuerus in the Megillah, which we just read, and I read it fairly quickly, but if you were able to get it right. In the Megillah, when Haman comes to Ahasuerus, he says, Yeshno am echad, there is a nation. He starts off the conversation, there is a nation. Now in Hebrew, when we say there is, the word is yesh. So what's this classical Hebrew word called yeshno, there is? So the Medrash tells us, the Talmud tells us, yeshno means yashnu. There's this nation, Haman says to Ahasuerus, knowing that Ahasuerus is going to be scared to start up with the Jews because he knows throughout history they have a record of God coming to their assistance. Haman says, don't worry, yashnu, this nation has fallen asleep. They've fallen asleep at the wheel. They're not doing the mitzvot anymore. They're assimilated. They're not inspired. They're at all-time low. They're asleep, and therefore God, so to speak, is also asleep. He's not. He doesn't have a good relationship with them anymore. You can be sure it's going to be fine. Right? So we have a story where a decree takes place. It's final. It's sealed by the king. And by all levels of logic and nature, there's just no way out. No way out completely. In fact, the word Esther, which is the Megillah that we read, the heroine of the Purim story, the word Esther comes from the Hebrew word lehastir, to hide. Because everything about the Purim story, everything is hidden. There's no hope. If there's light, it's very hidden. No one can see it. And that is the power of Purim. The power of Purim is that even at the darkest moment, that's what Purim is, such a different festival than all the festivals. The greatness and the happiness and the power and the depth of Purim is the ability that even at the darkest moment, even at the moment where it seems like there's no hope whatsoever, where God has forsaken us apparently, where we've forsaken ourselves, we've forsaken our soul, we're under oppression, just natural science and logic tells you that we're done. The ability of Purim is that we're not done and that we don't quit. And we don't despair, as the Jews didn't. And they worked their way back, and they davened, and suddenly, amazingly, everything suddenly transforms. So what's the perspective? What's the formula? What does Purim tell us? What's the lesson? How do we do this? What does it mean that Purim has the ability not to despair? And like he says in the book, never to quit, never to ring the bell. So we have to look at two critical Jewish words, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, which have been sort of the staying power that has been with us ever since we became a nation. There we are. Two words, emunah and bitachon. These, by the way, are not easy words. Okay, that's important to understand. Both emunah and bitachon are not easy, but they're possible. And they're fundamental to Jewish belief. It's this concept of not quitting. I mean, he says in a regular context, but from a Jewish point of view, this is so much more powerful. Why? Because we learn and we absorb these two concepts called emunah and bitachon. What does it mean? The word emunah means faith. The word bitachon means trust. Right? And just to explain it a little bit, you cannot have bitachon without emunah, but you can have emunah without bitachon. In other words, emunah is step one, and bitachon is step two. What do I mean? Emunah is faith. Faith means that even when we do have challenge, which as human beings, as limited, finite human beings, we never understand challenge, we never understand darkness, and nor should we. However, we have the ability to do two things. When I say nor should we, it's because God doesn't want us to do it. He doesn't want us to understand it. He's infinite, he's beyond us, he has a plan, he has a reason, we don't know. Sometimes it seems unfair, but it does happen sometimes. And therefore, it happens internally, it happens externally. But we'll never understand challenge and tests that we have, But we do understand that we have the ability to respond to challenge in two ways. The first is emunah. Emunah means that no matter how dark it is, no matter how challenging it seems to be, no matter how hidden God seems to be, we know that He's with us in the challenge. And we know that He essentially doesn't forsake us. And He knows that He's with us every step of the way, and therefore He gives us the ability, while the challenge is happening, to give it meaning and purpose as much as we possibly can. It's not an easy thing to do, not an easy thing to accept, not an easy thing to believe. But Purim gives us this ability. Purim is the yontif of Emunah. Like the Jews, they didn't despair. They found God while it was still dark. You know, the Megillah, the story that we read on Purim is called Megillat Esther. I just told you before that the word Esther means hidden, right? You know what the word Megillah means besides a story? It comes from the word Gilui, to be revealed, Legalot. Purim is Megillat Esther, to reveal in the hiddenness, to find, to discover while it's still hidden, to see the light in the darkness, that's hidden in the darkness. So that's Emunah. However, Emunah is not enough. Because God doesn't want us to accept challenge continuously. He wants us, while we have challenge, and while we're working on giving it meaning, while it's happening, while it's still there, at the same time, and these two things are hard to work together, at the same time, to trust and to positively hope and to move on with incredible hope that it will improve, that things will get better. While it's here, I accept it, but things are going to get better. Those two things are very difficult. That's bitachon, trust. Now, in the Purim story, that's exactly what happened. First of all, when Haman comes out with his decree, and as I said before, logically, there was nowhere to go. It was a fait accompli. They were going to be destroyed on one day. They didn't despair. They should have despaired, logically, but they didn't despair. What did they do while it was happening? They gave it meaning. They reconnected. They found God in the darkness. They regrouped. They gathered together. Mordechai gathered together 22,000 children. The Jews of Shushan gathered together to fast and pray. They gathered together to give it some meaning, to connect to God even in the darkness. And they had emunah. They had amazing emunah. They saw it as a tool. They saw it as a catalyst to reignite, to re-strengthen their faith in God. And not to give up. Never give up. Despair is considered one of the greatest downfalls of the human being. Sometimes it seems the only way to go, but that's the power of Purim. Never, never to ring that bell, never to quit. And at the same time, they had bitachon. Bitachon means they trusted that even though it seems like there's nowhere to go, they're going to find a way out. It's going to happen. How? No one knew, but it's going to happen. And it did happen. In fact, there's a beautiful Medrash. I'm going to say with you two beautiful stories of the Medrash. One is that, you know, there's a part of davening that some people say after Aleinu called Al-Tira. Yeah. Some good Chazonist pieces on it as well. Yeah. In South Africa, there was a big Chazon Mandel. He had a beautiful piece on Al-Tira, I remember. Every time I say Al-Tira, I think of him. So anyway, so there's a Medrash that goes like this, that when Haman came out of with King Ahasuerus and the decree was sealed, and he was so happy, Haman, that's it, he's got his way, he's going to kill the Jewish nation, he's going to have rid of these people. The Jews became aware of it. It was incredible. Suddenly he's walking down the street, full of himself, and he notices Mordechai, says the Medrash, going over to a group of school children. Of cheder children coming out of cheder, and he goes over to the one and he says, and he goes to hear what's Mordechai talking to the children with. So he goes close with an earshot of Mordechai and the children, and he sees going. He goes over to he hears Mordechai going over to one of the children, and he says to the child, "Psoikli psukecha, what pasuk, what verse did you learn today in cheder? What did you learn?" So the little child said, "I learned Al Tira mi Pachat Pitom." The verse is that God tells the Jewish people, "Do not fear sudden terror, and do not fear the destruction that comes from wicked people." That's very nice. Mordechai says to the second child, and you in a different class, right? You in the, you know, in the B class. So what did you learn today? So he says, I learned a pasuk, a different pasuk, from a different place in Tanakh, Utsa Eitzav Etufar, which means it's a pasuk in Tanakh which says that when our enemies organize a plan, the plans are going to be cancelled and so on and so forth. And then he asked the third one. And the third one also happened to have learned a great pasuk that says, God says, I will care for you, I will carry you, I will save you, and so on and so forth. And Haman is looking at this and he sees Mordechai smiling and he's happy and he's chuckling to himself. And this is like, you know, they just made a decree that they're going to annihilate the entire Jewish nation, which Mordechai took very seriously, as we know, at the same time. He put on sackcloth, he prayed. It wasn't like he wasn't taking it seriously. He wasn't in denial by any stretch of imagination. So Haman goes over to Mordechai and he says, what's going on here? He says, Mordechai says, very simple. We have a tradition that when you ask school children what they learned that day, what they learned has very big significance. I asked three children, they all said we're going to be saved. So I'm happy, it's fine, it's all going to be good. So we're going to do what we need to do, we're going to pray, we're going to repent, we're going to reconnect, whatever we need to do, we'll do, but it's going to be fine. So Haman became incensed, said the Medrash says. And he said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to kill the children first. At the end, he was hanged on me, right? Nothing happened, of course. But that was the power of bitachon. Emunah, to believe that God hasn't forsaken them, but the power to trust that, no, even when it seems that all is lost, it can still get better. Why? Because we believe fundamentally that nature is only one component of creation. God is supernatural. And therefore, when we connect and surrender to Him, when we trust in Him, when we give up control, when we stop thinking that we control the world and we start to remember that He controls the world, well, if He controls the world, He can change things around, as He does often. There's another beautiful little medrash like this, and I mentioned it the other day in a shir just briefly, but another angle to it. There's a chapter in Tehillim, a psalm in Tehillim. King David wrote Tehillim. This was way before Esther, of course, way before the Purim story. Right? King David lived before the first temple, and Purim was between the first and second temple. But nevertheless, we know that King David wrote Tehillim prophetically with divine inspiration, and many of them he wrote referring to future occurrences. So chapter 22, he writes a Tehillim dedicated to Ayelet HaShachar. You see it there in the red on top. Ayelet HaShachar has many translations. One of them is the morning star, which is a reference to Esther. Esther comes in the morning just before it gets light. It's very dark. That's what happened with Esther. It was the end of the Babylonian exile. It was the darkest time in Jewish history to date at that time, and then it got light. Many other reasons why Esther is called Ayelet HaShachar. And then he says that, so he's writing about Esther, and he says that Esther says to God, if you look at that second line, Esther said, my God, why have you abandoned me? And he says, I cry by day, but you're not answering me, and so on and so forth. And then suddenly she says, but you are the Holy One. In you our fathers trusted, right? So if you look at that chapter of Tehillim, it starts off very almost negative, but then it says, no, but we trust, and our fathers trusted, and so on and so forth. What's it all happen? What does it all mean? So the Medrash says like this, that King David wrote this prophetically about a story that was going to take place with Esther. And what happened with Esther was as follows. You know that Esther asked the Jewish nation to fast for 3 days, the people in Shushan, before she goes to King Ahasuerus to intercede on behalf of the Jewish nation. It says on the third day, Esther got dressed in royalty, which our rabbis tell us doesn't only mean she put on royal clothes, but it means she got dressed in spiritual royalty. She was uplifted. She was on a high. All the Jews had been praying for her. She was praying. She was fasting. And she's ready to go. And she felt this divine energy, this divine inspiration resting upon her. So she makes her way slowly to Ahasuerus' chamber. On the way, says the Midrash, she passes by a room where there was lots of idols, because Ahasuerus was a pagan worshipper. An impure room, almost. And suddenly the divine inspiration leaves her, and she feels like there's nothing with her. She doesn't have God on her side anymore. And she stops, and she panics. Here after this whole thing, she's about to go on this dangerous mission to try ask Ahasuerus to do something. And she's well equipped, she has the prayer, she's feeling it, she's feeling the holiness, and suddenly it's gone. And she panics, so she turns to God and she says, Kaili, Kaili, Lama Azaftani, my God, why have you forsaken me? What's going on here? I'm crying to you, but you're not answering me like this. The line, you know, the line's gone dead, right? The prayers don't seem to be working. And then the commentary says, suddenly Esther realized that there's something even greater than prayer. Prayer is important, and we always pray when we're in a time of trouble. But there's something even greater than prayer. What's that? Bitachon. Trust. Positive thinking. To give up control to God. Let Him run the show. Say, God, we have no control anymore, because the way it looks down in this planet, there's no way out. But you can do anything. So suddenly she says, but you are the Holy One. In our Father, in you our fathers trusted. B'cha batchu avotenu. Bit suddenly she conjures up this amazing bitachon. And then walks with confidence over to King Ahasuerus. And that was the moment when everything turned around. Ahasuerus welcomed her. He came to the party. The Haman, the king, couldn't sleep. Everything just took a turn. And the most bizarre turn of events, everything just turned completely around and was completely transformed. Not in an open way, by the way. As we look at the story of Megillah, everything that happens, every part of the puzzle seems completely natural. It's just you have to, it's again the same theme. You have to discover the light in the darkness. You have to discover Megillat Esther. You can only realize the miracle of Purim. You know, when you read the miracle of the splitting of the Red Sea, it's obvious. God took the sea and He split it. That's miraculous. If you look at the Purim story, if you take each chapter separately, nothing supernatural actually happens. But if you understand the history and the context and the sequence of events, you realize that this puzzle is impossible to happen. Statistically, it's impossible to happen. It must be the hand of God. Which is the same reason, by the way, we talked about this concept of Megillat Esther. Do you know that the Esther, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but Esther, the book of Esther, is the only book in Tanakh. There's 24 books in Tanakh, right? Chumash and Tanakh. It's the only book in the entire Tanakh that does not have in it the name of God. Look at the whole Megillah, you'll see. There's no name of God. No Elohim, no Hashem, nothing. Yet, we are taught that the Megillah happens on many layers, and God is hinted in the Megillah many times. In fact, we are taught that every time it says the word Hamelech, the king, it means Ahasuerus, but also means God. And there's always to read the Megillah that way to see how God is allowing the decree to happen, because He wants the Jews to reconnect, but then He's the one who annuls the decree. So God is there all the time. It's just completely hidden, right? In fact, some people write a Megillah in such a way that every column of the Megillah starts with the word Hamelech, because Hamelech also means God. Just, it doesn't only mean Ahasuerus. But that's a deeper way of reading the Megillah. That's the hidden way of reading the Megillah. But that's what Purim is. Purim is that no matter how dark it is, it's the power to be able to come back. But it requires emunah, it requires bitachon, and often requires a mindset change. A mindset change that challenge can paralyze us, but we can also look at challenge and refuse to be paralyzed, refuse to despair, and turn it around so that we become much more positive and much more believing and much more connected, and we start discovering meaning and purpose and even light in the darkest of times. I tell a story of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov once took his students for a walk, and they went in the shtetl there, and they met the Wasserträger, which means the water carrier, right? I think his name was Reb Chaikel or something. So Baal Shem Tov, in front of his students, he says to the water carrier, Reb Chaikel, how are you? Oh, so Reb Chaikel starts to kvetch. He says, Rabbi, it's not so easy. Listen, you know, carrying water is heavy. I'm not getting any younger. The shuls that want the water are up on the hill, in the mountain somewhere. They've got to schlep up the hill. It's back-breaking. Anyway, he goes on and on. He kvetches. So Baal Shem Tov says, okay, Reb Chaikel, I hope things get better. Have a good day. And he goes back. A couple of days later, he tells his students, let's go for another walk. They go for the walk, and they meet the same water carrier, Reb Chaikel. So he says to Reb Chaikel, Reb Chaikel, good morning. How are you? He says, Rabbi, I'm fantastic. Thank God I still have a living, I still have a job, I haven't been fired. People need water, so it's a guaranteed thing, you know, they always need water. No, it's a little bit hard, so we say, yeah, slap a little bit, but you know, I have kayak still, God has given me strength, I can still do it. And he carries on upbeat. So Baal Shem Tov says, thank you very much, have a good day, and he goes back to the base. Now, then he turns to his students and he says, this is the point of life, he says, often it's not the situation, it's how we deal with the situation. Now that wasn't a very terrible thing, but it's still, it's got to do with the way we look at something often, right? Do we look at something negatively or do we look at something positively? Do we look at something superficially, the way it seems on the surface, or do we look at something on a deeper level to find meaning and purpose, to discover greatness even behind darkness, right? And trust that we're going to find the light and it's going to become light. There's a story of a great Hasidic Jew, his name was Rav Shmuel Munkus. And he was an interesting guy. He was an older chassid, about 250 years ago. He was a very great man, but the way he served God, he was always like, he was a comedian a bit. Like he was always doing something a bit different. That was Rav Shmuel Munkus. So one time he was just away, he was out of town for a day, and unfortunately his house caught fire. Everyone was okay, thank God, but all his possessions were burned to the ground. So when he came back to a house that wasn't there, and everyone was standing around, and they looking at him with a bit of empathy. And he's okay, he's upbeat. And he comes near the home, and he starts making a blessing. Baruch, Atah, Hashem. And I think he's going to make a blessing that you make on tragedy, you know, like God's the true judge. And he keeps talking, and he says, Baruch Atah Hashem, he says, I'm thanking God for not making me an idol worshiper. What's that got? That's one of the morning blessings. What's that got to do with the... So I asked him, what was that all about? He said, no, I was really, really excited. Why? Because I have emunah, because I have belief, because I'm a Jew and I believe in God, I still have my God with me. If I didn't, my God would be burnt with the house. He says, so I'm really, really happy that my God didn't go up in flames together with the house. Right? I'm just telling you the story because perspective sometimes is everything. But it's not just perspective, it's having that tremendous resilience and power that comes from the very depth of our soul. I think I've told you, let's go back to this idea that Purim is like Yom Kippur. How so? Because we are taught that on Purim and Yom Kippur are 2 days of the year. Remember, we've gone through this many times, that the soul has 5 levels. And the deepest part of the soul, we're not going to go through it now, but the deepest part of the soul, the deepest level, the core essence of the soul called Yechidah, the 5th level, is that point of the soul that's never damaged, that's never corrupted, that never loses hope, that is always pure, always connected, always resilient, and it's that point where we have to build up from, right? So Yom Kippur, that's why on Yom Kippur we pray 5 times. Because Yom Kippur, where we do tshuva, where you reconnect to God, even if we're totally gone, even if we're totally at the point of despair, physically, materially, emotionally, spiritually, whatever the case is, we always have that point of the soul that we can rebuild from. Purim is the same thing. I'll just end off with 2 ideas, because I want to leave some time to eat homintashim. Not too many, Sarah says, but a little bit. We have to. It's a custom. It's a mitzvah to eat homintashim today. Right? So, one idea, which I just heard last night, an amazing idea. You know that in the story of the Megillah, Haman builds a gallows for Mordechai. And he says, his wife and family give him this advice. They go and build the gallows. Etz, yasu, etz, make this tree. Gavoa chamishim ama. Make it 50 cubits high. Which is very high, by the way. It's like 25 meters. Right? And then go tell the king. At the end, Haman, of course, was hanged on the same tree. Okay. Now, why do we need this piece of information that the tree was going to be 50 cubits high? I mean, everything in Tanakh is exact. I mean, it looks like a completely irrelevant piece of information. Yeah, it's a relevant part of the story that Haman was going to build the gallows, and he was planning to hang Mordechai on it, and everything turned around. As the Megillah says, V'nahapochu, it all turned around, and he was hung there instead. But why is it relevant for us to know that it was Chamishim Amah, 50 Amot? So one of the great Hasidic masters says the following idea. Beautiful idea. We know the sages tell us that when the Jews left Egypt, they had also sunken very low. It says that, because we say in the Haggadah of Pesach, that we were just just in time, God took us out of Egypt. Had he left us there longer, we'd still be there and we'd be completely lost. Why? Because the Kabbalists tell us that there are 50 levels of impurity. 50 levels of impurity. And the Jews in Egypt had sunk to the 49th level. Had they sunk to the 50th, that's the point of no return. And they wouldn't be able to go there. So God took us out just in time, at the 49th, so that we can rebuild. We rebuilt over the next 49 days, which is why we have the 49 days of the Omer, and then we got the Torah and Shavuot. So this is something that I've never heard before. It's absolutely amazing. The reason why Haman made a gallows of 50 amot, maybe he wasn't even aware of this, was because his family told him. Now, many things in the Megillah happened. I don't know if they were conscious of what they were telling him, but what was happening was that in the time of Purim, apparently, the Jews had sunken to the 50th level. And Haman's family tell him, you can do this, because now Pesach could never take them out, so they're lost, finished. Once they got to the 50th level of impurity, that's it. And that is the power of Purim. Even if you think you've sunk to the 50th level, 50 Amma, 50 cubits, Haman goes on that gallows, not you. Because Purim, Pesach was before the Jews got the Torah, before they were a nation, before they had the power of the soul. It's different. So then, Taka, if they would have gone to the 50th, it would have been the point of no return. Purim means that even the 50th level, you can still get out of the 50th level. So no matter how deep a person's lack of self-worth is, if they think, which is probably a mistake anyway, but if they think that they can't do it, either because of external challenge, or because of internal challenge, or spiritual challenge, I can't do this anymore, it's not for me, I'm not inspired, I can't do it, I have too much tzoris, like this and that and the other, which some of it would be legitimate, some of it not, but even all of it which is legitimate, makes it hard, it makes it difficult, makes it that while it's happening, we have to have emunah and have to give it some meaning, but we also have to have bitachon and resilience that comes from the very essence of our soul, that fifth level, that pinta layid as we call it, the essence of the soul, that gives us the ability to rebuild, to come back, to take a step forward, to grow, to give meaning and purpose to whatever we are in life, to take whatever happens to us and respond with it with hope, with resilience, with positivity, and with meaning and purpose. And that's the power of Purim. Because Purim is the Yontif in the darkest time of history, that's its power. Because we all have our dark moments. We all have moments where we can't see any miracle, we can't see any hope, and it's those moments where we have to draw the inspiration of Purim and take that step forward. Now, Purim happens, however, one important concept to understand about Purim is that Purim happens with the power, as we said a few weeks ago, the power of a group. Because when Esther went to Ahasuerus with hope, with prayer, and then afterwards with bitachon, she didn't do it on her own. She said, I need the people of Shushan to be behind me. I need everyone to pray and fast together. The power of together, because the power of a group is how we support each other with that point of resilience. It's how we support each other with not giving up. Because alone, it's very difficult to discover that point of the soul. But when we support and help each other, and give to each other, and reach out to each other, that's part of the Purim power, and that's why Purim has such a theme of unity and coming together. And that's why on Purim we have these special mitzvot. Obviously, one of the mitzvot of Purim is to celebrate, so sometime during the day to have a meal and celebrate. But two of the mitzvot that we can do throughout the day is a mitzvot of unity, mitzvot of giving. The one is to exchange food gifts, two foods to give it to our friends and so on. That's a mitzvah, just to give each other food. And it's an interesting thing, you know, we give each other food. It's not like, you know, I give you food, you give me food, but we end up with the same totals. What's the point? The point is the connection. The point is that we're giving to each other. We're getting to the mode of unity and giving. And then, of course, there's the other mitzvah of giving a little bit of money to two people in need. So besides wishing you a very happy Purim, and besides encouraging you afterwards when we finish to eat Hom and Tashin, let's take a moment. You've got all underneath your chair. You should have a mishloach manot. Yeah. You can exchange it with someone else. Just exchange it with someone sitting next to you, and you'll be doing the mitzvah. There we are. That's it. Anyone doesn't have? And one second.